From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. All the world's a theme park, and all the men and women merely customers. Wherever you go, shopping malls, restaurants, or third places like Starbucks, the theme park's influence looms large. You can't even escape theme parks by going to the movies. The four Pirates of the Caribbean films have grossed an estimated $3.7 billion at the box office, all based on a Disney theme park attraction. So, we're off to explore theme parks today. We'll find out what it's like to smoke pot at the Magic Kingdom, the happiest place on Earth. And we'll visit the sexiest place on Earth, a theme park called A House of Holes, the setting for Nicholson Baker's new novel. Also, Karen Russell introduces a gator wrestling theme park in the Florida Everglades in her debut novel, Swamplandia. But first, Scott Lucas. He's a cultural anthropologist and a former trainer at Six Flags Astro World in Houston. So it's only fitting that he's written a book called Theme Park. It's an exploration of the evolution of the theme park, from the pleasure gardens of the 19th century to some of the weirder contemporary parks, like Migrant Mountain, where visitors get to simulate the experience of illegal immigrants crossing the border. Scott Lucas tells Ann Strangechamps he considers theme parks a kind of liminal space.
I think the liminal space is a good way of looking at it. You can think of that in two senses. I mean, in the sense that Starbucks has been talking about the third place and the idea of a place that's not home or work, it opens up sort of a new sense of space in which people can interact, enjoy themselves, and discover new senses of self. And in terms of that last area, discovering new senses of self, that's the classic idea of liminality in anthropology. It's the notion that you enter a space, you engage in certain rituals, and then you leave that space having been transformed. And so much of what theme parks do and other spaces today, theme spaces like casinos and themed restaurants, there's that focus on saying, we want you to come here, enjoy yourselves, and also be transformed.
Mm-hmm. Well, thinking about one of the very first true theme parks, Disneyland, what was Walt Disney's vision?
I think his vision really was to sort of change the face of public amusements. He had such a successful career in terms of, you know, being an animator and an industry insider, entertainment insider. With his theme parks, I think his vision was to try to collect all the things that he saw in his life growing up in Marceline, Missouri, going to kiddie attractions and seeing, you know, sort of the surly carnival worker, and trying to change that and say, well, what could I do? How could I open a theme park that reflects kind of the American character, that draws on my abilities as an animator to create stories, visual or otherwise, in a theme park? And how can I create a space that everybody will enjoy, that will focus on family entertainment, and that will be a place that people remember? And so I think at some level, Disney, whether he said this or not, I think he probably wanted to eventually change society through the theme park. It's something I think we could look to as legacy today and say, indeed, if you look at the media industry that's been transformed by, say, Pirates of the Caribbean, a theme park ride, you could say, indeed, the theme park has transformed who we are, has transformed society itself.
It's interesting that, you know, this first true theme park, Disneyland, was created by a movie maker, you know, Walt Disney, whose job was to tell stories. Because couldn't you say that a theme park is really, at least the parks like Disneyland, it's like an entire fictional world. It's like somebody's created a movie set. You can walk into the movie, but it's all a fiction.
Oh, absolutely. Some of the work I do today, interviewing designers who develop attractions for theme parks and for other consumer spaces, this is the key point, is that you need to focus on effective forms of storytelling. If you move through Pirates of the Caribbean, the famous ride, essentially it's a 3D version of a story. You have everything in there, from exciting characters like Jack Sparrow to plot development. You move through the different vignettes, different scenes. It's remarkable. It all happens in a span of 3 or 4 minutes. And that's what's, I think, truly amazing about this form, is that you can enter a ride and you can get the story in such a short period of time. So I think, indeed, that when you go into a theme park, it's all about telling a story. And the story can happen at different levels. It can happen at the level of a theme land within the theme park, or it could be within one of those attractions.
You know, Walt Disney had this kind of cryptic remark. He said, Disneyland is the reality. What did he mean by that? Or what does that mean to you?
I think if you look at a lot of contemporary philosophers, French philosophers like Jean Baudrillard, who have talked about this, they sort of suggest to us that when you go into a theme park, when you go into a theme space, there's a recreation of some place. And indeed, we see this on the Las Vegas Strip, where we see versions of Paris and different versions of Italy and ancient Rome and so forth. So there's a work of simulation going on, where we take bits of reality and we recreate them for guests in theme parks and in theme casinos. And at some point, I think a lot of these French philosophers pointed out, you would have a situation in which the simulation supplants reality. Walter Benjamin, another theorist, talked about this when he discussed what the effect of technology would be on photography. So if you reproduce something, does the aura, does the sense of the authenticity, the originality of the original disappear? And for a lot of these theorists, the answer is yes. And so when you get the recreated reality of Disneyland, it becomes more real than the real. This is, for me, one of the most interesting aspects of this research, because I think it's a debate that involves so many different points of perspective and trying to understand, what do we mean by a simulation? What's original? What's a copy?
So you mean partly that you visit Disneyland and you walk through this idealized version of small town America, and then you get out and you look at real small town America and you don't want to live there anymore. You want to live in the Disneyland version.
Yeah, I guess in a sense, and that's kind of what happened, with Celebration Florida, which Disney sort of pulled out of. And just about a couple months ago, I read a story on New York Times, and it was talking about Celebration Florida had its first murder. And this was a big deal because, you know, the idea is that you've created this idyllic space, and wait, the real is sort of creeping in. It's sort of like, you know, in The Matrix, welcome to the desert of the real. We didn't count on this happening. We're forced to sort of, again, reconcile the relationship between fantasy and the real. So it's quite interesting, I think, when you create idealized versions of reality, and then you sort of question, well, what's reality and what's the simulation?
Mm-hmm. Well, today, of course, theme parks have continued to evolve, though I must say, until I read your book, I had no idea quite how bizarre some of them have gotten. There's a really unusual one called Kidzania in Mexico mm-hmm. City. What is Kidzania?
Yeah, Kidzania is an interesting chain that originated in Mexico, and I think there are 10 or so of these small theme parks, and they're going to open up more, and I hear there's one maybe scheduled for the U.S. They're basically miniature theme parks where kids, I think the age range is 2 through 14, they can participate in sort of everyday careers that they might have when they're adults. So there is a section where it's a simulation of a air traffic controller and pilot area, so the kids get to take on the roles. There's another section where they get to work behind a counter of a hamburger joint, and they trade in these currency. They're called kidzos. And as the kids are doing all this, the parents are sort of upstairs behind glass watching all this sort of transpire. I mean, I haven't been to one of these places, but it sounds to me like a sort of a laboratory where you throw your kids in and they're doing all these careers, and then sort of as a parent, you're watching them up above.
Thinking, you look good as an air traffic controller.
Yeah, this could be your future career. The adult supervisors are actually called supervisors, and these are people that sort of give the kids the instructions and tell them what to do and so forth. When I discovered this, I was really kind of blown away, because it just sounded like something you would read about in a novel or in some futuristic, you know, movie about theme parks.
Well, there's a slightly sinister side to it also. You uncovered there's a lot of corporate branding that goes on.
Oh, yeah, there's a ton of it. I mean, so hospitals could be sponsored by Johnson & Johnson, and I think in some of them, you know, the burger joint here we go, another version, a simulation of a simulation of McDonald's. And so I think it's one of these tricky places where you think about there is a value for kids to learn skills. They can learn teamwork skills. They could develop their creativity. But then the sort of downside of this is you have all these corporate messages and branding that is being used. And then adults and corporations essentially are giving kids directives on what to do. And it's kind of like the classic thing when you have a young kid who's working on some art project. And if the adult starts to dictate, well, you have to do your lines this way and your perspective should be done this way, in a sense, you're quelling that creativity. And I think it's the same thing. I think the intentions are good, as far as kids developing important skills. But then is it good that branding and products and corporations are sort of the ones dictating this and instilling in kids the values of corporations and branding? And that's, I think, the side of it that concerns me the most.
Mm. And so this is back to the theme of the theme park as a form of social engineering.
Yeah, and now I think it's full-fledged with the brand. You know, you could read Naomi Klein and hear a lot about this, where it's sort of like our most intimate values, our everyday lives, are being dictated by brands. And again, if you get it in a theme park, because it's immersive, because it's multi-sensory and multi-experiential, I would argue that's going to have a deeper effect on you versus just, you know, seeing an ad in print media where it's like, oh, okay, this is an ad for Nike or Budweiser, and it's telling me how to be. But if you experience that, particularly as a kid, in an immersive space, I think the effect is going to be double or triple or even more than that.
Hmm. Well, and I guess the very concept of theme park, even that phrase, by now has become a metaphor that's seeping into many different parts of our culture. The idea of the theme park is finding its way into political discussions. Haven't there been critics who've charged that the U.S. invasion of Iraq has produced a terrorist Disneyland?
Mm-hmm. What's interesting about this, I think when a theme park gets used in political discourse, when it gets used in popular culture and isn't referring to the actual theme park space, I think people are focusing kind of to the negative connotation. And we see sort of in an exercise here in semiotics that people are very suspicious of theme parks. The connotation seems to be something like it's a fantasy space, it's escapist, it's non-intellectual. It's a place where you sort of get a whitewashed version of reality or of society. So when we use it in political discourse, I think we realize that people do have this connotation like, well, if it's a theme park, it's not serious, it's escapist. So therefore, we apply it to our political enemies or to situations like the war in Iraq that we don't find very palatable because we want to sort of draw on that negativity that's associated with the theme park. And I think that's another interesting reflection on the earlier discussion about authenticity and the idea that a theme park, you know, inherently isn't authentic. So we can apply it then as a metaphor to focus on other situations that seem to be inauthentic or politically challenging or whatever.
Scott Lucas is the author of Theme Park. He spoke with Anstrain Champs. What are your thoughts on theme parks? You can share them with us by sending us email through our website at ttbook.org. You'll also find a link to our Facebook page there. Coming up, getting high in the Magic Kingdom as we continue our hour on theme parks. I'm Jim Fleming. It's to the best of our knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
Support for To the Best of Our Knowledge comes from the University of Wisconsin Online Bachelor of Science in Sustainable Management, developing leaders with the critical skills to grow a green economy. Information is at sustain.wisconsin.edu.
Theme parks are bizarre places to begin with. Add a controlled substance and a visit can be truly mind-blowing. John Jeremiah Sullivan wrote an essay for the New York Times Magazine recently about an unusual family trip to Disney World. Sullivan, his wife MJ, and their 4-year-old daughter Mimi went to the Magic Kingdom with some friends, Trevor and Shell, their 5-year-old daughter Flora, and their younger son who goes by the name of Lil Dog.
When the children were huddled lumps in various spots on the sofa bed, Trevor and I stood on the balcony. He talked about how challenging it would be the next day and during the next days and nights in the park, not being able to smoke. That wasn't high on my list of concerns. In fact, I was foolish enough to think that the fact of Disney, that we would be spending our time in the heavily surveilled park, might banish the very notion of smoking weed, easing Trevor's many withdrawals, and making my life easier too, in that I wouldn't spend too much time stoned, only a few puffs at night like this. It would be a non-issue in terms of domestic harmony. Trevor wasn't trying to hear that at all. He was definitely stressed. "I'm gonna lose my mind in there," he said. "Have you ever been in there?" "I had once when I was 11. I didn't remember much. It bounced off." "Well, we go every year," Trevor said. "And every year I feel like my skull's about to split open." "I always figured you were doing brownies," I said. "I do brownies," he said. "I have brownies, but you know." "I did. Edibles are good, and wise heads move toward them over time to save their lungs, but there's something about the combination of oxygen deprivation and intense THC flush that comes with smoking, and in particular from smoking joints. There's no real substitute for the abuser. A brownie can alter your mood over hours, but a joint swings a psychic broom around you. It clears an instant space." "I actually saw this thing on the internet," Trevor said, "where people were talking about getting high in the park." "At Disney World?" I said, as if I hadn't been listening. He led me back inside and quietly cracked open his laptop on the kitchen counter. "Check this out," he whispered. Only the two of us were awake. I dropped into one of the swivel stools in front of the bright screen. I was reading before I knew what I was reading, but it was like a chat room, or a forum. Forum is the better term. A motif of cannabis leaves and naked women holding glittery buds ran down the left margin, a pothead forum. Trevor scrolled it down to a posting, the subject of which read, "Hello from Disney World." An anonymous person, evidently the veteran of a staggering number of weed-smoking experiences in the park, had done a solid for the community and laid out his or her knowledge in a systematic way. It was nothing less than a fiend's guide to Disney World. It pinpointed the safest places for burning the proverbial rope, telling what in particular to watch for at each spot, isolated footpaths that didn't see much traffic, conventional smoking areas with good hedge cover, places where you could hide under a bridge by a little artificial river. Those were its points of interest. The number of views suggested that the list had helped a lot of desperate people. The main point was clear and consistent. Be ready to book it. No sooner had we pressed our fingers onto the biometric scan pads, because if you can't trust Disney with your biological data, then old Trevor began to show signs. He hadn't been able to smoke that morning, quarters too cramped. He was craving. Not that he acted jumpy or cranky. I could just tell from the body language and sentence length that it was on his mind. Nothing like an enclosed space. And Disney World, for all its gigantism, manages never to let you forget for a second that you're in a very tightly enclosed space to make a head start scanning for exits. Lil Dog and the ladies were sailing by up above on the Dumbo ride in three successive elephants. Mimi had a tentatively happy face. It said, "I'm ready to think of this as fun, as long as it doesn't go any faster or higher." Trevor and I leaned on the railing like bettors at a track, smiling and waving every time they went past as if we were dolls with arms hooked to wires. Trevor had his phone out with the internet dialed up to the guide. He consulted it when they were on the dark side of their orbit. Checking it against a map of the park, we determined that one of the spots mentioned wasn't too far away. A little used maintenance pathway with trees alongside it and some dumpsters. Given a properly positioned lookout, you could have a puff in relative calm. We slipped away. Now we were truly at Disney World. A person didn't come here every day. What is the scene here? Hello, primary colors. Hello, quickly fading microdramas of passing human faces, incessantly deciding whether to make eye contact. Hello, repeating stalls and gift shops. We were walking on the balls of our feet. The surface of things had become porous and permitted of the potential for enjoyment. Where were our womenfolk and Lil Dog? Let's find them. Let's be good fathers. Tomorrow was Father's Day. Oh my God, I didn't even remember that. We don't need to remember that, Trevor said. We are that. We are Father's Day. Next memory, riding on the mechanical boat through the It's a Small World attraction, continually spraying Mimi, who looked as if she had been boiled in a tank. Her cheeks were so red and her little forehead was glowing. The whole time I was spraying, she was waving at the dolls, acknowledging every single doll's wave with her own, showing an OCD-like desire not to miss anyone. It seemed that she misunderstood the nature of the dynamic, believed we ourselves were part of some parade, being observed by the dolls. A more natural idea, I suppose. Why would you go floating by in a boat to look at children standing along the banks of a river? They would be looking at you, because you are a princess. Flora was angry because Lil Dog hogged their family's sprayer and was just sitting there spray-fanning himself right in the face. And by the end of the ride, he had squirted all the water away. "Son," Trevor said. No sooner did we enter Epcot than Trevor started checking his phone, and while I won't bore you with more detail about that business, there being no tediousness quite like dope or tediousness, suffice it to say that the rest of the day was spent on pendulum bouts of ecstatic, hyper-attentive parenting, followed by separation from family to indulge addiction and vice. There is deep yearning at Disney. What you feel when you're in the state we were in and all of your emotional pores are wide open is yearning. There is something at stake here for the families, in terms of that knife edge between joy and disappointment. So when you see people whose kids are definitely not having fun, but are standing in place and screaming, having to be dragged along by their leash harnesses, there's a throb of empathetic sadness. They are not having a good Disney. I looked at Mimi. Was she having fun? I thought so. She was smiling. But I knew there were times in my own childhood when I must have seemed to my parents like I was having a blast, while being inwardly tormented by some irrational worry. Ah, youth. How many of my genes had she inherited, and could I teach her how to play them better? You want joy for your children, but you yourself have brought them into this world of suffering. The strangest thing that happened was the very last thing that happened. As we were leaving the park on the evening of the last day, it began to rain a monsoon-like rain. You'll have to believe me when I say it was exceptionally violent. The next morning, I said to one of the bellboys at the hotel, "You guys probably get weather like that a lot, huh?" He said, "No, we don't." It was as if a black spaceship had swooped down and blocked out the sun. Sheets of wind were tearing through. Lightning continually exploded just above our heads. The tram caravan kept having to stop, which made it only scarier, as if they had driven us out into the open in some sacrificial way, as target practice for an offended storm god. Also, it was disturbing to see the clockwork perfection of the Disney machine threatened that way. It hinted at a larger underlying weakening of something. The tram we were riding in was open on the sides and covered above only by a plastic canopy. We were exposed and getting blasted. But we had the Disney ponchos. Shell had made us all buy them. At a gas station, so possibly they were knockoffs. But they worked. And by sitting close together with all of them spread, we could make a tent. It must have looked very weird. On the other hand, I'm positive that every other person on the tram wished they were under it with us. And I'm pretty sure at one point we did have some other people's kids. Underneath, in the dark, the children were loving it. Mimi and Flora screamed in terror every time the thunder boomed, but their terror was full of joy, and afterward there was laughter. And it was wonderful to be able to cover them. We had the solution for this, barring a direct strike. Later, when asked, Lil Dog said that this had been his favorite ride.
That's John Jeremiah Sullivan reading an abridged version of his New York Times Magazine essay, "You Blow My Mind, Hey Mickey." Sullivan's a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine and the Southern editor of the Paris Review. He's also the author of a collection of essays called Pulphead. If you have questions or comments about the program, you can send us email through our website at ttbook.org. You'll also find a link to our Facebook page there. Coming up, we'll visit two fictional theme parks, Karen Russell's Swamplandia and the sexual theme park in Nicholson Baker's new novel House of Holes, as we conclude our hour on theme parks. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Karen Russell's one of America's most promising young writers. She won the National Book Foundation's 5 Under 35 Award and is one of Granta's best young American novelists. Her critically acclaimed debut novel, Swamplandia, has been described as a tale that could have been concocted by Flannery O'Connor in partnership with the Brothers Grimm. And much of it takes place in two theme parks. Karen Russell sat down to talk with Steve Paulson recently. They began with the book's opening words.
Our mother performed in starlight. Whose innovation this was, I never discovered. Probably it was Chief Big Tree's idea, and it was a good one, to blank the follow spot and let a sharp moon cut across the sky, unchaperoned, to kill the microphone, to leave the stage light's tin eyelids scrolled and give the tourists in the stands a chance to enjoy the darkness of our island, to encourage the whole stadium to gulp air along with Swamplandia's star performer, the world-famous alligator wrestler, Hylola Bigtree. Four times a week, our mother climbed the ladder above the gator pit in a green two-piece bathing suit and stood on the edge of the diving board, breathing. If it was windy, her long hair flew around her face, but the rest of her stayed motionless. Nights in the swamp were dark and star-leopard. Our island was 30-odd miles off the grid of mainland lights. And although your naked eye could easily find the ball of Venus and the sapphire hairs of the Pleiades, our mother's body was just lines, a smudge against the palm trees. Somewhere directly below Hylola Bigtree, dozens of alligators pushed their icicle overbites and the awesome diamonds of their heads through over 300,000 gallons of filtered water. The deep end, the black cone where Mom dove, was 27 feet at its shallowest point, the water tapered to 4 inches of muck that lapped a coppery sand. A small spoil island rose out of the center of the pit, a quarter acre of dredged limestone, and during the day, 30 gators at a time crawled into a living mountain on the rocks to sun themselves. The stadium that housed the gator pit seated 265 tourists. Eight-tiered rows ring the watery pen. A seat near the front put you at eye level with our gators. My older sister, Osceola, and I watched our mother's show from the stands, and when Ossie leaned forward, I leaned with her. At the entrance to the gator pit, our father, the chief, had nailed up a crate board sign, "You watchers in the first four rows, guaranteed to get wet." Just below this, our mother had added, in her small, livid lettering, "Anybody could get hurt."
Ah, that is wonderful. Thank you.
So that's that.
Yeah. And this is the featured attraction at this theme park, what you call Swamplandia, this woman who swims right past 30 alligators.
Right. The park, you know, they have some kind of shabby cafe and like a ticky-tacky gift shop, but the real attraction is Hylola Bigtree, who's their headliner, this woman alligator wrestler.
Well, tell me about this family. Most of the story is told in the voice of this 13-year-old girl, Ava Bigtree. Who is she?
She's quite stunted in a lot of ways. She's a 13-year-old, kind of a tomboyish alligator wrestler, and she's the youngest child in this family of self-described world-famous alligator wrestlers, sort of aspirationally titled. And she's sort of the engine of the whole island at this point because her older siblings are sort of wising up to the shabbiness and the real financial peril that their park is sort of teetering on the edge of insolvency, and their mother's recently died. And I think Ava still very much wants to believe in the idea that they are this sort of mythic tribe of alligator wrestlers, you know, living out in the middle of the swamp. And she sort of has this kind of kid conviction that she can save the whole island by becoming a famous alligator wrestler like her mother.
Hmm. This is set at a theme park, sort of this fictional theme park, which is obviously kind of an elaboration of real theme parks. Why did you decide to create a theme park here?
Well, so I grew up in South Florida, and that's sort of like the most theme parks per capita in the continental U.S. I mean, there's Disney World in Orlando, but we just have like a bunch of sort of like B-side parks. There's the Miami Sea Aquarium, It's just chock-a-block with jungles. There's a parrot jungle, a monkey jungle, some lesser jungles. If you're just driving to the Burger King, you see this thing called the Coral Castle, which was built by this weird Ukrainian man to lure his love across the seas. You know, just this entire eyesore of a castle built out of coral rock. So there are all these sorts of like weird monuments to, you know, fantasy and delusion up and down the Dixie Highway. As a kid, I think I was really struck by that mix of fantasy and reality. So we would go out to the Everglades, which was really a genuinely mysterious and sort of terrifying and beautiful place to me. You know, it's about an hour from downtown Miami, and then suddenly you're in just this alien landscape of sawgrass, mangroves. But also it's full of little kind of constructed realities like Swamplandia.
Now, there are some things that happen in your theme park. For instance, the alligators jump up, I guess, feet out of the water to grab chicken carcasses. Does that kind of thing really happen?
Oh, it absolutely does. Isn't that terrifying? I sort of think I got some false cred for being imaginative with this one when there really are. You can go on YouTube and watch Gatorama. You know, there's Gatorland in Orlando, which I did visit while I was watching this just as, you know, kind of a refresher. They're not live chickens that are strung up there, but they definitely jump to get drumsticks off a wire, and they can jump, you know, 7 feet out of the water, which is such a strange thing to watch on a Wednesday, you know, these primordial lizards jumping up to eat a Purdue chicken breast. You're like, oh, well.
Pretty impressive.
For sure that was worth my $9, but yeah.
Well, maybe also kind of terrifying too. Yeah.
I think that's what's so striking about Florida is, you know, you get off the interstate, you're right next to all of this industry, and then there's a primordial, you know, this Mesozoic lizard that basically hasn't changed for 200 million years, just chowing down on some Purdue chicken breast. You know, it's really an incongruous kind of a place.
Now, there's another theme park that figures into your novel. It's the World of Darkness, and it's quite different from Swamplandia, isn't it?
It is. The Big Trees have kind of a mom and pop shop. And while it is also basically founded on a fiction and they're, you know, and very much for profit, I thought that they were really respectable in a way because they genuinely love the environment that they live in. Their gig's a little more sustainable than the World of Darkness. The World of Darkness is like a Walmart, like a dark Disney World a little bit, I think. And they move into town. They're a franchise. They're international. There's one in Mexico. And their big attraction is the Leviathan. If you've ever been to a water park, I actually was recently at one on Six Flags. You go down those big tubes and it really literally feels like you're being digested. And that's the idea behind the Leviathan. It's this big whale that digests thousands of tourists per day. You go down these tubular slides and get spit out into a lake of fire. And there, you know, there are these Dantean rings of hell, and it's really cheesy, over the top.
Well, you actually have a great description of the Leviathan, which I'm hoping you could read.
Absolutely. Watching people board the ride and get released down the chute was like watching an eerie factory assembly line. Real whales, Kiwi had to believe, were less orderly but more expedient about their consumption of plankton. There were no lines winding around outside their great teeth, no hand stamps and tickets. The real whales just opened wide and destroyed. At the apex of the tongue, the ride operators came running out like bandits to pluck the eyeglasses and rings and wristwatches from the startled riders. You couldn't wear these things into the deep inner pools of the Leviathan. You couldn't have heart arrhythmias, spinal injuries, psychoses. You couldn't have a baby growing inside you either, not if you wanted to plunge headlong into the jacuzzi streams of the Leviathan. No pregnancies, no stowaway futures. A chubby new hire in a tight World of Darkness security shirt was escorting a pregnant woman in a pink and blue striped bathing suit down a side stairway just now. Twins, he mouthed to Kiwi when their eyes met across the long hallway, rolling his eyes as if he had just caught a nervy shoplifter.
And we should mention that Kiwi is Ava's older brother. Once business goes sour at Swamplandia, at the family business, then Kiwi actually leaves home and takes a job at this rival theme park at the World of Darkness.
Right.
And to some degree, what you're doing is you're kind of setting up this contrast between, as you say, the mom-and-pop theme park, this family-owned business, Swamplandia, and the corporate world. And clearly, your own sympathies lie with the small family business.
I think so. You know, I think I have some antipathy towards Disney, who really bought up all the land in Orlando. And I think even as a kid, my sympathy sort of lay with these really more tawdry. You could really see the seams of the fantasy at a place like the Monkey Jungle, right, where all the monkeys are eating white bread and things are falling apart. I think people like the big trees. They're really tenants of the land itself, and they really actually do love this ecosystem and the flora and fauna on their island versus sort of the Walmart of theme parks, where it really did always feel to me like this factory assembly line. You know, it's just this weird machine designed to provoke screams out of every rider. You go down the chute and it's manufacturing the same emotion in everyone, and you're just having this kind of grimly standardized experience. So that manufacturing line versus sort of the quirkiness and the eccentricity of a mom and pop place.
Now, you mentioned the fantasy element in particularly the smaller family theme park. When you were growing up, when you visited these kinds of theme parks, did you buy into the fantasy? I mean, did it seem fantastical to you?
You know, it did and it didn't. Ava's character, some of that manifests where she, on the one hand, she's a willful dupe of their own family mythology. You know, I think she really understands that she's sort of the emergency generator on this island. It's her belief that's powering the place. So, and I think everybody in the book, you know, to include Kiwi and many of the adults in the book, are very credulous, and they sort of kind of teeter between knowing and not knowing very difficult truths. So that's all to say that as a kid, you know, I wanted the fantasy to be true, I'm sure, even as I sort of recognized this is a mighty alligator wrestler, and at the same time, this is a man who looks like my music teacher who is exploiting an animal.
Well, I guess I'm partly wondering if there's something special about South Florida that feeds into this kind of fantasy life or this imagination. You know, it's a very diverse cultural place there. You have the Everglades there, which is kind of this mythic landscape. Does that sort of create its own kind of fantasy that's different from other places you'd find in the United States?
I love that question because I think it's really true. I mean, just geographically, it's a liminal place, right? So it's this peninsula jutting into the ocean. So I think there's always this sense that the coastline is being revised. The swamp itself is this weird limbo that's not really land and not really water. And then, as you said, it's such a heterogeneous place. There's so many different groups of people, and few of whom have, you know, none of us really went back more than one generation. Miami was a really sleepy backwater until maybe the 1950s. For a fiction writer, it's sort of a wonderful world to be steeped in because there's a lot of self-invention happening. Fantasy is the state's actual industry. And then I think, again, the way that, you know, the tides work, the way that the landscape itself seems to be in a kind of flux, in a limbo, that made it so much fun to set a really uncanny story in that environment.
Karen Russell's the author of Swamplandia. She spoke with Steve Paulson. If Hugh Hefner had been a bit more like Walt Disney, maybe he would have invented the House of Holes, the world's first sexual theme park. Or maybe not. Maybe it takes a novelist to dream up something that, inventive. Nicholson Baker leaves very little to the imagination in his new novel House of Holes, a book of raunch. And yes, it really is set in a sexual theme park. And he's not kidding about that subtitle. Here's Baker with an excerpt.
When she got back, her roommate Rianne was there. Rianne's lips were very red. She'd been sampling the new lipsticks, probably, and she was holding on to Dave's arm. The hand end was in her shirt, obviously doing something tender with one of her breasts. Rianne hurriedly drew him out. There was a pad of paper, lots of hasty writing scrawled on it next to where she was lounging on her bed. "So, you've discovered my arm," Shandy said with an edge. Rianne nodded. "He has a lovely touch." "That he does," Shandy agreed. Rianne said that she'd found out quite a bit about the arm and where it came from. "It belongs to someone named Dave," she said. "I knew that," Shandy snapped. "He went to a place called the House of Holes," said Rianne. "There Dave had requested a larger, thicker penis. Apparently you can do that, but at a price. The director, this woman named Lila, said to him, 'Would you be willing to give your right arm for a larger penis?' Dave said no at first because his right arm was necessary for his work. But Lila said it was only temporary, only till someone found the arm and took it back and stuck it on him. Dave said, 'Oh, if it's temporary, sure.' so he underwent a voluntary amputation right near the elbow, and his arm had the self-contained life support pack grafted on. "You sure did find out a lot," said Shandy. "I must say his touch is extremely sensitive," Rianne went on. She threw herself back on the bed and laid the arm on her chest. Shandy watched the hand push aside the sides of Rianne's shirt and find her breast again. "Hmm," said Shandy. "I don't know about this. I found him, not you." She felt finger snappings of jealousy. Rianne's lips parted. "Oh my gosh, his fingers know what to do," she said, flushing. The hand was gently rolling her nipple like a tender round pea. And then it suddenly surrounded her whole breast and shook it once. After that, it turned and began crawling over her belly toward her pajama pants. "Are you just going to let that happen?" Shandy said, riveted. Yes, she said. "Could you dim the light?" Shandy turned off the overhead light and watched the arm undo the knot of Rianne's pajama bottoms. It disappeared. Rianne went, "Whew." Shandy turned away. "He's found it," Rianne said, "and boy, he's got the touch of a master."
This is near the very beginning of the book. This is kind of an introductory passage for readers of House of Holes, but it's a pretty good way to start.
Well, it's a book that has all kinds of strange things happening, and they all seem to lead in the same direction, which is cheerful sexual bliss.
I guess that's what I was hearing in your reading as you went along. You're smiling as you write this, and I suppose for a variety of reasons.
Well, here's the thing about theme parks and places, special places you go. When you get on the subject of sex, often they start to get dark. You know, you get a dungeony kind of thing happening, strange leather things with rivets in them and all that. I like to go places where people laugh and where their thrill rides and they're genuinely thrilled in a laughing kind of way. And I think that's the part of sex maybe that we leave behind. We think we're doing something dirty when we do the dungeony kind of thing, but really we're just getting distracted.
Well, one of the things I noticed as I read through House of Holes is that there does seem to be participation. So much of what you know about pornography is that somebody gets hurt or somebody's doing something they don't want to do. That seems to be not part of the theme park that you've created at all.
Well, it's a voluntary place. Of course, you get sucked into the House of Holes. You seem to be chosen. So people are sucked down their drinking straw or they're pulled into the hole in a golf course or they fall into someone's purse. That was one of my favorite ones where this guy's just saying, "What have you got in that lovely little purse there?" And he leans and looks in it and the woman holds it open for him and suddenly, whoosh, she's looking at her driver's license. But somehow you get chosen and you're pulled in and then you meet the director named Lila who figures out what you really want. Maybe something that you don't even know you want.
Which is the opportunity to lead you in all kinds of different directions. I guess I want to know where you started. What was it about the idea of a theme park in the first place that made you think it was a good lens to explore sexuality?
Maybe it started way back watching Yellow Submarines when they have the holes there where Ringo's head suddenly pops out and Paul and George and the video game Portal. There's a nice feeling that is somehow connected with, I think, with sexual arousal, where you go into a different universe, a hormonal universe. The normal rules don't apply. Things shift, body parts, people are moving. You start in the middle of things, you jump around. Chronology isn't intact. It's a fun house. It's a house, and it's fun. It's not dark. It's really great, but it isn't going to follow the normal rules of physics.
And because so many of the things that are written and filmed about sex are so bad in a variety of ways, I had the clear impression that you were enjoying this, but that you also wanted to put it apart from the bad thing. In fact, maybe I'm off base here, but I thought your creation of the porn sucker ships might be an example of that.
Yes. Well, the porn sucker ships, at one point, a couple is up on a crag in the House of Holes, way up high on a chemical crag. And the woman is absorbed by looking at these mountain zebras. And the man says, oh, my God, there is an AR-35 porn sucker ship. That's a porn sucker. You can see by the red tips of its wings. And what these ships do is go around piloted by various people, including this kind of smoky southern guy named Dune. Piloted, and they suck up the bad porn from cities. So Dune had to suck up all the bad porn from Providence. But then once you've sucked it up and put it in the porn sucker ship, what do you do with it? So they have this problem with the House of Holes. One of its problems is it has an enormous secret underground cavern or tank, vat of terrible porn. And things happen there.
There is, in your mind, bad porn. You make a distinction between good porn and bad porn.
Well, I think we're all experts on it now, so we all know that that's true. Of course there is. There's stuff that's just deeply disturbing, strange, unpleasant. But the basic thing is, on the internet, of course, there's a lot of video porn. And you can go to the movies and see things that are startlingly explicit in some ways. And why don't they work? That's the question. Say, a movie like Friends with Benefits has a tremendous amount of nudity, and Justin Timberlake is very fit, and the woman is pretty, and it should work, but they're naked. And here's the interesting thing, is nakedness and comedy don't really work very well together in a visual medium. And what I find is that the only way you can laugh and be sexually aroused at the same time is when you're reading a book. Because nakedness is so overwhelming to the brain's sexuo-visual sense that your sense of humor just goes out the window.
You actually are something of an expert on this. This is the third book you've written that has a sexual element to it anyway. There's a book called Vox that was about phone sex, and another later, The Fermata. You got some criticism for The Fermata, I think, because the character stopped time and used it to undress women.
Right, yes. And people said, have you actually done that? You know, I mean, is this something that you've done? It is a darker or more impermissible a book that explores forbidden territory, I guess. It was really just an adolescent 13-year-old fantasy of mine that I turned into a novel. Because it seemed like the right thing to do at the time, yeah. 1994.
Well, this one, if you'll forgive me, it shows some signs of the same thing, only here you're still enjoying the subject, but you also clearly want this to have some literary value. House of Holes isn't just one sexual vignette tacked on top of another, is it?
Literary value is one of those elusive things. I want the book to be about life and to be a sort of a document that makes a case for why life is a good thing and also why things are funny. I want the book to be entertaining. I'm, I guess, a literary kind of writer, so I like the conversation to be surprising. I don't think you always have to go in a certain direction relentlessly. You can stop. One of the things that I was happy about, I had a whole scene in the grown rooms. The grown rooms were these places where people go and it's dark and you wear these glowing wrist bracelets and you're not allowed to say anything. All you can do is groan. I was kind of pleased with this idea and I had a whole scene in there. But then I had a kind of flirtation between two people who meet in a store and they end up just putting on the wrist bracelets. And she says, shh, you can't talk. Remember, it's the grown rooms. Let's go in. And then they stop. So sometimes you don't have to have a consummation. You can lead up to the doorway and stop. I don't know. Maybe that's what makes it literature.
Now, I know that at least in the world that obeys the laws of physics, I understand you can't look into someone's purse and disappear. Could you imagine a sexual theme park like House of Holes as a reality in our world that obeys our laws of physics?
You can imagine it. It's much better, I think, nicer, more fun to imagine it in your mind than the reality, in the same way that when you see a movie, there are freckles and people's nakedness that, that is a sort of insistent kind of nakedness. There are lots of things that we think about sexually, really extreme things, that we would never, at least I'm a kind of mild-mannered guy, we would never ever do them. But we entertain them. This is a theme park that you probably should never visit in reality, but that you can visit a chapter at a time within the covers of a book.
Do you think the world has had that same kind of reaction? I don't know what reaction has been. I've read a couple of reviews of House of Holes. Were you surprised at the way it was received?
Not too surprised. I think that it strikes people different ways. There was sort of one kind of review that worked as porn, but it's a terrible novel.
Well, and there was one review that I read that actually, not really a review so much as a personality piece about you, and it was titled The Mad Scientist of Smut, which is a curious title because it was pretty clear that he liked the book, and he likes you.
Well, I liked the title. See, if they'd said The Mad Scientist of Porn, there would be no alliteration. The Mad Scientist of Smut conveys what's going on here, which is it's not your everyday, ordinary sex book. Things happen here that don't normally go on. So I was thrilled by the title. I was even more thrilled by the piece about me because, look, there's three books that are very, very explicit, and then 10 books that are about all sorts of other things. I mean, there's a book about library history in there. There's a book about the beginnings of World War II. Why is that? That's because sex is terribly interesting, but all kinds of other parts of life are terribly interesting, too. Sometimes you're in the mood to think about and feel pained about the beginnings of World War II. Sometimes you're in the mood to just be out there and just be bodies doing things. And it's a response on my part to the insane-making variety of possibilities that life offers.
Nicholson Baker is the author of House of Holes, a book of raunch. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast. You can buy a copy of the program by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for program number 821A, Theme Parks. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Doug Gordon, with help from Ann Strainchamps, Charles Monroe Kane, and Veronica Rickert. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Special thanks to special guest engineer Brittany DeAnda. Our technical director is Kirill Owen. Today's engineer is Steve Gotcher.
PRI, Public Radio International.